Welcome to another episode of the Untangling Web3 podcast. So for those of you who've actually looked at the title of this episode and been following the podcast so far, this is the 52nd episode we've done, which means it's been 1 year since this podcast started. Jack is absolutely beaming. You can see his cheeks going all red there. Or is it the hay fever? I think it's actually just hay fever. But yeah, mate, it's been 52 episodes already. It's gone so quickly, hasn't it?
I know, it's crazy. Who'd have thought back when we started this a year ago now, pretty much to the day that we've released our first episode. So this time last year, we'd actually recorded 5 or 6 episodes already. And if you go back and look at them, they're not that great. I think we made a rocky start maybe. And I think we've come a long way. But yeah, you know, what was the stat? Like 99% of podcasts don't get to the second episode or something like that. So yeah, I'm really glad we've made it this far and we seem to still have an audience. So that's always good.
I think it's 99% of podcasts shouldn't make it past the first episode or something like this, but we've just kept going no matter what, even if no one's listening. But yeah, so we've actually got something special in mind for this 1 year anniversary. We are going to take a look back at our favorite clips throughout the year, basically. This is really exciting. Jack and I have both chosen some of our favorite moments from the podcast, and we're basically going to select them, show them, play them, listen to them, and then give some reactions to them. Jack doesn't know what I've chosen, and I don't know what he's chosen. So let's see. This should be quite interesting.
Yeah, I wonder what our preferences are for good clips. What makes a good clip in our eyes? This is going to reveal a lot about us, Alec. But yeah, no, this is exciting. And it's great to look back both on the episodes we've done, just the two of us going deep and nerdy into topics, and also with all the guests we've had, because we've had such a high quality and caliber of guests on the show. It's great to go back and see some of the best moments, some of the best insights that we've managed to get from them, right? So this is going to be, it's going to be a bit of fun, I think.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I've just chosen 5 clips. They're all me speaking for 5 minutes. That's about my favorite things. No, I'm joking. We're going to, we're going to choose 2 clips each from guests, 1 clip of the other person, and then maybe one of our favorite definitions throughout the year. So do you want to kick us off, Jack? Do you want to show us your favorite clip or one of your favorite clips from the podcast this year?
Yeah, sure. Why don't we do that? So for the first clip I've chosen is from episode 17. This is from Heather Lee Flannery, so obviously a friend of the podcast. She's been on multiple times. This clip is actually from the first time she was on the show, when she was talking about personal data sovereignty and how that kind of relates to Web3, how there are issues in Web2, and how she is working to solve these alongside some of the challenges and opportunities of AI. So yeah, let's see what Heather had to say.
So when you ask about data sovereignty, we have an opinion here at Equidium Health that all of the information about you is powerful and utilizable by you and others you trust in order to improve your prosperity, your well-being, and help you achieve all of your goals, including the goal of simply having vitality, energy, mental health, physical well-being. That means you have to span multiple bodies of law, and you have to change the notion of the role of the data subject versus the role of data custodians like governments and corporations. So when I say data subject, I mean the person that the data is about. So Alec, as a data subject, you have data under the custody of an endless number of corporations and governments presently. Mm-hmm. You may be only somewhat aware of little pieces of your data that is actually under your own custody. In today's Web2 world, there are very few options and very little ability for you to express intent about some fine-grained or detailed nuance of a decision that you would like to have made with the information about you. In fact, that's nearly impossible in most circumstances. We live in a binary off or on, opt in, mm-hmm. opt out. Mm-hmm. What are called blanket consents and fundamental assumptions about what that means for your privacy, agency, and dignity. Many of those assumptions are wrong.
man, I love that clip so much. I love Heather so much. She's so great. I remember when she came on the show, we were both so excited and invigorated about Web3 just because of how she talks, like her project, her passion for everything. It's just so inspiring. And data sovereignty, we said it's one of the key pillars of Web3 and everything like Web3 is pushing towards, but it's really intangible. It's really difficult to describe why data sovereignty actually matters. But when you look at projects that kind of Heather is pushing, like that one just described there, it's so obvious why it matters. Like healthcare is so important. Everyone understands like how much we need healthcare day to day, and not just healthcare, like efficient, reliable healthcare. And the information that actually pertains to healthcare is so private, so confidential. It's so important for people to have complete control and ownership of that data. But also, it's very convoluted. Like healthcare is so much more than just going to the doctor and having operations and surgeries and what your, you know, prescriptions are. It's your day to day. It's how much you're going outside, what you're reading on the internet, and how much you're sleeping. And I think projects like this are so important. The idea of actually disseminating this information, but in a private way and retaining complete ownership over that data as well. Yeah, I love that clip, mate. That's such a good one.
Yeah, that's why I picked that clip, really, is because I think Heather distills one of the key themes we've seen over this full first year of doing the podcast and everything. I think most of our guests have said this idea of data sovereignty that you've just described is exactly what most people are trying to solve in various different domains. So obviously Heather was talking about it from the perspective of Quidium at the time. Now she's moved on to other things, you know, AI space, but she was talking about it in that episode, not only about, you know, how it operates in the healthcare space and how important. I mean, I remember one thing she said about how, I think it was your postcode basically is like the biggest determinant for your health, that single piece of data. So it's very important that you manage these things privately. So she both talked about it in this very specific, tangible use case, but then also, you know, across that episode articulated, you know, how this applies to various different domains and fields beyond that. And also how it's part of this overarching theme of Web3, so I love it. And I also love that if you're watching this on YouTube, you can see in the background on the mirror behind Heather, I think you can see some of the cleaners are coming into the office. So clearly Heather's burning the midnight oil. She's a hard worker, which also typifies a lot of the guests we've had on the show, I think.
I think you have to be in this space. Like, it's so competitive. But yeah, I absolutely love that. I mean, that's a hard one to follow. Like, it's such a great clip and really explains such fundamental things in Web3, like data sovereignty and how it applies to healthcare. So mine is from another absolute friend of the podcast who I'm a massive fan of. This goes back to episode 11. It's Untangling Generative AI with Colin Fitzpatrick. So it's one of the early ones. We both look very baby-faced. I don't think we're so stressed then. Less wrinkles, maybe less haggard. Colin looks great, of course. And yeah, this was one of our first guests, actually. So I think we were both a bit nervous. And Colin's quite well known in the space. And he really just blew us away with this clip, didn't he, Jack?
Yeah, he was an awesome guest. His energy, as you'll see, is pretty much unmatched. And I'm just a little bit worried to see how fresher faced we looked 11 or 10 months ago when we recorded this one.
And I think, yeah, when we actually recorded this, it was like the AI ChatGPT boom, right? It kind of just started getting into the headlines. Everyone was like, oh my God, now I understand the power of AI. It was the real killer application moment. But that hasn't really changed much. Like, the whole year has just been AI after AI after AI, upgrade after upgrade. Like, we're on ChatGPT 4.0 right now, and that's just blew everyone away, me included. So this stuff is still incredibly relevant, and that's why I decided to have it as a clip. And here we go.
Basically, ChatGPT just didn't bother talking about that. They just made an amazing revolutionary product that is so simple and everyone wants to use it. That's what we need to focus on doing. And everyone is way too concentrated on the tech. And that's just natural. That's how it happens. We've already seen some of these AI agents, and you know, we're going to see an awful lot of it more, taking their own initiative to just go and execute tasks. And one of them even went on to TaskRabbit and got a human to input the CAPTCHA, you know, the little letters thing. And even the other person on the other side said, hang on, how are you doing this? And the AI lied and said, I'm blind. So like, if you guys have ever heard of a guy called Eliezer Yudowski, and you can find him for several, I think he's got a book and or a podcast or several things going, we're all going to die. And he describes half a dozen different scenarios where if AI is given a task to, you know, go and do something, it'll shortcut it and it'll mean curtains for the rest of us. It's quite depressing to think of. But yeah, I mean, look, so just the other day, Elon Musk announced his X.ai. And I sat and watched or listened to all of the, you know, Twitter Twitter spaces and went into a lot of detail. And ultimately, he's doing it with a different approach, which is to understand the universe. And he's got some of the best mathematicians, physicists, deep learners, all this sort of stuff, because that's what they want to do. And if you think about, you know, AI is going to be as smart as the average human relatively soon, and then after that, it'll be smarter than Einstein, and after that, God knows, you know, and imagine what sort of things it can bring. I mean, his point is, well, until it sort of invents something new, you know, some new physics theory or proves something, well, you know, what kind of use is this? So he's doing it that way. But he also said that we're 5 or 6 years away from a digital superintelligence. And, you know, that's basically the singularity, when after that, we don't know what's going to happen. Yeah, it could be lights out, but it also could create a utopian world of complete abundance where no one needs to work and there is no hunger or poverty or anything like that. The way I like to describe it is that, you know, if we take and look at with Tesla's Optimus robot and what the Boston Dynamics guys are going to do within 5 years, you know, they'll be selling those things for $20,000 and it'll work 24/7, 23/7 for no money and, you know, stuff like that. It'll completely obliterate, you know. He says, if you think the market for cars is big, wait till you see the market for human labor. It's insane, you know. So anyone working digitally is, you know, is going to be challenged by these AI bots, and everyone working physically is going to be challenged by these, you know, humanoid robots. But when we have that, what it'll do is it'll have an effect basically like the Gutenberg printing press. So whenever that was invented, before that, books, usually the Bible, cost the equivalent of several thousand dollars. And then in comes the printing press, and it goes down several orders of magnitude. When we get AI and robotics working on stuff, maybe we can do that with, let's try food for starters. Make food cheaper by 90%. Yeah. Then let's do shelter. Then let's do healthcare and maybe consumer products after that. And then, you know, maybe a couple of $100 from the government will give us all that we need to leave. And then we can all, you know, be happy ever after, or maybe kill each other. Who knows?
And not just the AI. But,
well, I think a lot of people will, because they need it. You know, they need a job. They need a sense of purpose. How do we, you know, when you know, oh, well, nice to meet you. What do you do? I mean, that's it. People are somewhat, not completely, but somewhat defined by the job they do. And when they don't have a job, you know, look at all the millionaires and billionaires who've made more money than they can possibly need. What do? They mostly continue working.
Well, like, that's a really good follow-up to Heather's, I think. I mean, I found myself just getting lost in Colin's voice though. I could listen to him talk all day, I think. And there's a lot to unpack in what he said, right? He covered actually quite a lot of ground there. And as you said, you know, even though that clip is dated, right? He mentioned XAI right now, before it's even called Grok. That's how far back we're going now. A year is like a lifetime in AI, it seems. But I think everything he said is still just as relevant, right? Touching on points about how close we are to the singularity, right? He said 5 or 6 years away, that's now 4 or 5 years away. So that's a little bit scary. And he was talking a lot about at the start of the clip about the idea of AI agents. And I think that's one of the big themes we've seen maybe in the last 6 months or so, is people building their own agents based on these open source tools now that you have to do certain things, right? If you look at some of the demos that came from the most recent ChatGPT 4.0 launch, right? A lot of people were saying that this is like the movie Her, right? And people will be able to make these agents to act as a, for companionship. They can help you do your homework. They can look at your screen now. The day I never thought I'd see Sal Khan working with AI, and in that, it's kind of a mind blowing. But yeah, it was a super interesting clip. And I think, you know, you could have picked many from that episode, but really good stuff there.
It was, I mean, Colin has got his finger on the pulse when it comes to this stuff. He just seems like he's absolutely at the center of so much of this stuff. Like you say, he covered so many different things, you know, the singularity, Gutenberg printing press, the dissemination of information, all this kind of stuff. I think one of the, you mentioned it as well, I think one of the exciting things we are seeing, and it's come so far, even in the year from that clip, it's gone from just these chatbots that were incredible to, like you say, now being able to process much more visual information in real time, generate images, soon to generate videos, all this kind of stuff. But I think the thing that is missing that Colin touches on there is the idea of AI agents with more autonomy, more agency, being able to go into the world and interact, purchase services, interact with other AI agents. And I think this is the stuff that we touched on in our episode on AI, where you really need a lot of the other Web3 building blocks, like cryptocurrencies, like digital identity, databases, all these things. And we're still waiting for that, I think, that full integration with AI and amongst the other technologies to really go, you know, to the incredible place that AI can go to. But it really is dependent on these other technologies. So yeah. And the other thing that I really like that he touches on there is the Gutenberg printing press, the idea of like lowering the barrier to entry. And that's what I think AI does in a lot of ways. I think it really lowers the barrier to entry. If you want to start a business or you want to generate some code, like, you don't need 20 years of expertise or a lot of money to pay someone who does. Now you just pop a prompt into ChatGPT and boom, it's done. I think that's the most exciting thing about the AI that we're seeing right now, is it lowers the barrier to entry. So yeah, I love that clip. I love the topic, and we'll almost certainly get Colin on again in the near future.
Yeah, 100%. I completely agree that idea of lowering barrier to entry is fundamental, and programming is the one I would pick as well. It allows you to learn so much more rapidly, ask direct questions, debug code, that kind of thing, which is seen as a scary process for new developers. So I think that is one of those things. And also, I really liked how Colin touched on the bigger societal implications of AI, right? The whole, I've seen Naval Ravikant talk about this a lot, the future state where all the kind of menial labor of mental work is now outsourced to AI, and we all have time for creative pursuits, right? And then maybe we're all living on universal basic income. These are the kind of issues that I think Colin was hinting at. So yeah, maybe if we get him on next time, we can dig into those a bit more,
and we can go full time on the podcast and our creative pursuits and not have to earn a 9-to-5 living to pay for this.
Yeah, when we're out of a job from AI, hopefully that won't happen in the next year. But yeah, cool. So maybe to take a kind of hard left from AI, another topic that's been talked about a lot, not just in the last year, but maybe the last 3, 4, 5 years even, is the idea of CBDCs, right? And we had John Velisarius on in episodes 24 and 25. So we had a two-parter with him where, you know, he is a real guru of the space. And he broke down just what CBDCs are, the value proposition. And I've picked a really nice clip here where I was asking him about the privacy implications of CBDCs, right? Because a lot of people are worried about these. And I really liked how he addressed this in this clip. So let's take a look at what he said.
Sure. I mean, I think I want to touch upon the privacy topic, because I think it's a big topic on its own. Again, you know, not an easy one. But I think with one of the challenges I think that we all have in discussing these topics is that people are concerned about, and sometimes we're very rightfully concerned about, you know, things that may happen, right? At the end, it doesn't mean that it will happen. It just means that it may happen with you and with when you end up with solutions that are rolled out that have that have things that are of concern for consumers. Privacy is a very big topic, and in many markets it varies widely in terms of the degree of concern from the general public. In some markets it's not a concern at all. In other markets it's absolutely the most important thing, and I think it has a lot to do with trust and faith in government. It all has a lot to do with perhaps the geopolitical, the sort of context in which countries are operating in, degree of surveillance of government, things like that. So I think it has a lot, there's a lot to consider, to unpack there, to look at privacy as a topic. But again, the thing is that a lot of that can be completely controlled and implemented in with solutions that provide a very high degree of privacy for consumers as well. Yeah. So there are projects, worked on them and are working on them as we speak, where users can have a high degree of anonymity with regards to purchases that they make. So just like buying things like with cash, either you can control how much information you share with a merchant, you can control how much you sort of provide to them as a result of the transaction, and only in extreme circumstances, by if values are above a certain amount and a number of conditions are met, then obviously things are disclosed to regulators if need be, right? So things, situations like that. But I think that's also a very important thing to sort of highlight for people to, you know, express that concern and to make it a very important topic. And then obviously it gets factored into the design and the building of the solution. So not all CBDC solutions are the same as you implement them. So you can have high degree of privacy and anonymity. It's more complicated, but it's doable. Or you know, a very much transparent solution where every transaction can be monitored and so on if the central bank and or regulator would, you know, deemed it necessary, or deemed it desirable rather. However, consumers always have the option to not use it at all. I think so. There's a balance between, you know, you're providing something that, you know, people don't want to use, and then all of a sudden people don't use it. So, you know, then it's an immediate feedback loop where, you know, people just stay away from certain things.
Man, that's great. Like, I think privacy always comes under the spotlight when we talk about anything Web3 and crypto. So much of this space is purely about privacy preservation. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions because of the space we're in that have come about that you need to talk about or have a discussion about. And education is an important piece on this. When we think about cash, it's peer-to-peer. That's one of the most beautiful things about it. When I give you £20, it's completely under my control that I give you that £20, and it's completely private. You know, no one else really has to know that I've given you that £20. And people are freaking out right now that the CBDC systems that are being implemented around the world won't be private, and it's going to allow governments to track every single facet of your day-to-day lives. And like John said there, some governments may do that. If you're in a certain dictatorship, for example, they probably are going to track their CBDCs. But as we've seen with Digital Pound and the CBDC that we're offering in the UK and also the projects in Europe, privacy is at the forefront of why they're developing these systems, and it will be maintained through technology almost certainly. But yeah, super important to talk about that stuff.
Yeah, and I particularly like that clip because John gets into some nuance that you don't normally hear around this topic, right? So CBDC, I think, is typically, for many people, is actually a bit of a dirty word, and I don't think it should be, because as he said, it really is this wide spectrum of solutions. It doesn't need to be blockchain based. It doesn't need to be related to Web3. You can interpret CBDC as something that's fully centralized. It's just digital, right? So I think it's a really interesting avenue of that conversation that is very nuanced. And I also like that he even highlights at the end that it's not necessarily like it is something that will or should be forced on a population. They should always have the option to still use digital cash. They should always still have the option to use, you know, physical money and physical cash and traditional systems. And I think that dovetails nicely with what we've learned and described about Web3 itself, right? It's not necessarily just there to disrupt systems and overthrow them, right? It's there to be a credible alternative. So that's kind of why I like that clip.
I would maybe challenge that idea now. Like, at the end of the day, a government has a certain amount of resources, right? And if, say, 0.01% of the population still want to use physical cash, and we've talked about this in great detail, that the usage of physical cash is really declining, like, then it then becomes like a cost value analysis, right? Is it now worth us spending the billions we spend every year to support this 0.01% of the population? Or should we just shift everyone to digital cash? And I think, yeah, if it was an academic exercise, you should always support both and not force anyone to do anything. But I think when it comes into practical terms, governments will choose what is best for the majority rather than, you know, the minority sometimes. But yeah, it's an interesting point. It'd be really interesting to see if that does happen and if people do move to CBDCs or not.
Yeah, and that's why I like this conversation, right? We can have different positions on it a little bit, right? I think maybe we slightly differ in that respect, and whether a lot of people talk about CBDC as helping the unbanked. I think John talks about this term as well, but you don't want to end up accidentally unbanking people from the physical cash system. But yeah, it's a big debate for another time as well. So yeah, I think you've got another clip for us, Alec, right?
Yeah. So actually, we didn't come together and discuss our clips beforehand, but yours leads very nicely onto mine. This clip was episode 39. With the second Colin that I'm going to introduce, Colin Butler. So this was Untangling Institutional Adoption with Colin Butler. He works at Polygon, so obviously a massive player in this space. And me and Jack both came away from this episode saying that this guy explains things so well. Everything was so dialed and so clear and crisp that we learned a lot in the episode about on how to communicate the kind of the everyday problems in the space. And this clip specifically is about Bitcoin and some of the misnomers with the space, people thinking that it can only be used for criminal activity. If you're a criminal and you want to transact with someone around the world to buy drugs or nefarious goods, then you should use Bitcoin. And Colin, as you'll see, explains very nicely, that is not what Bitcoin's about. Everything is recorded in an immutable, transparent way. It doesn't mean that all your data is going to be put on chain so people can know what your groceries were last week, but everything is provable online. And that's so much better than, say, the fiat system we have now, potentially. Here we go. Here's the clip. Yes.
I mean, what people don't realize is it's all about transparency. It's very easy to track if you're a malignant actor. So I would say the biggest misconception right now is that if you go on public blockchain, you're going to be front run by people and everyone's going to know what everyone else is doing. and it's going to unleash this wave of criminal activity. I, from my personal experience so far, that's just that. It's the opposite of that. There's organizations out there that are very good at tracing every block and every transaction that anybody ever does. So if you're a criminal out there thinking about using Polygon, probably not a great idea, or Bitcoin or any of the other blockchain technologies. So I would say that's probably the largest misconception, is the idea that going on public blockchain is either a good idea if you're a criminal or a bad idea if you are a traditional enterprise.
Yeah, that was a really great explanation from Colin about, again, one of the biggest misconceptions that, you know, Bitcoin, crypto in general, Web3 tools are good in quotes for criminal activity, because the transparency we espouse all the time and of, as one of its main benefits, that is exactly the thing that that helps law enforcement to track illicit activities on the blockchain and things like that. And we've seen cases after cases of companies like Chainalysis working with cross-governmental operations spanning the globe to take down various criminal activities using the blockchain because of the transparency. The data is there, it's all in the public, and I really like that. It is a big misconception, and obviously Colin explains it super well here. Like, he's such a clear articulator of the value proposition of these technologies. I think it leads into another misconception, which is an interesting one, about, you know, people say, well, then I can't, how do I use the blockchain in a private way, right? Where is my privacy? And again, this gets into that nuanced conversation I think we've had with multiple people in the past year about the fact that you can use blockchain in a hybrid sense, right? It's a public system by default, but you can make your data private. But if you're trying to do a kind of illicit things with funds, then typically that's the bit that you can't really get away with, right?
This is one of the hardest things to explain. It's like the kind of the juxtaposition between everything is logged on chain, so you have complete provability, very bad to then transact with drugs and all this kind of stuff. And on the other hand, we're saying also it's super private, so no one knows what the data really means. And it's like, this is one of the most difficult things to explain in the space. It's like everything is logged on chain, but that everything means nothing unless you say have to prove it, for example. And I think that's quite an important thing. Same with cash. Like, I want complete peer-to-peer control over my cash, so I have complete privacy in that transaction. And it's privacy. So this is private, not anonymous. And that's quite important. Like, the only people that need to know about a small transaction, say me buying some chewing gum, is me and the vendor of the chewing gum. But if I'm all of a sudden buying a house, you really probably want other people involved in that, because that's a lot of money. So there's a bit of due diligence that needs to be involved. And then you have KYC and all this kind of stuff. And this is something we're really seeing come into the space. Like, maybe not on the Bitcoin layer itself. Obviously, you can transact vast amounts, but the layers above that, the exchanges, for example, KYC is becoming so important at the exchanges, as we've seen with all the companies that have gone down because they haven't done sufficient KYC. And I think this is one of the things that's really come into the space, and why this kind of this juxtaposition between those two things is quite important to understand.
Yeah, and this also really dovetails nicely, I didn't expect this, but into last week's episode, we talked about custody, right? Because we talked about you can custody your assets with these third parties, these exchanges and things like that. And actually, we talked about that being a single point of failure. But in terms of law enforcement, they're the entities that normally are working together when compelled to by the law to freeze funds, for example, in these cases where you can detect criminal activity. So I think it's another one of those aspects that you consider with custody options. And it shows how they can work for the betterment of the world, right? Not just as gambling houses for speculation, let's say. So that covers it for our favorite clips of guests in the last year. So now, Alec, this is a very fun moment for me and you. I'm going to show you my favorite clip of you this last year. And I think this one encapsulates some of your favorite talking points. So it's from episode 37, which is about smart contracts. And this is about you giving a really nice use case for smart contracts that includes some of your favorite things. So like supply chain, IoT and automation, right?
Myself, basically. It's me talking about myself for 5 minutes.
Yeah, this is one of Alec's classic monologues. So let's watch it.
So how does this stuff work? You know, imagine you have a smart contract that's effectively collecting the data. Okay, let's take the farmer, for example. He has some milk that he takes from the cow. As soon as it goes into the bottle, he tags an RFID or an IoT chip on that milk bottle to know this was created on my farm. I can produce a digital signature to prove that, and only I can do that for this good. Okay, So then we have a smart contract that actually monitors that milk and provides real-time tracking and verification of the goods using that farmer's digital signature at each decision point along the supply chain. And as it goes through the various actors, they can verify instantly that it came from the previous actor, and they can provide their own signature on that as well, be it automated with a smart contract and automated with IoT chips, where you just have an IoT chip going past a gate. But the point is, we've programmed every kind of transaction on the blockchain, which is effectively this being passed from point to point, actor to actor, and it allows us to really efficiently verify the authenticity of the milk, for example, from origin all the way through. And you can start to do, you know, more intelligent things like prove transparency, prove that it was below a certain temperature, prove that it took a certain amount of time to get there. And I think smart contracts, when we think about IoT devices and IoT devices being used in supply chain, is extremely important. It's a lot of data that you don't want to handle manually. You want to automate the entire process. You don't want human error involved in the loop. And really excitingly, you want funds to be automatically released, right? If I have a smart contract between, say, the distributor and the farmer, as soon as that IoT device says that this milk has gone through that gate, the funds should be released by a smart contract from the distributor back to the farmer. And this is a really powerful thing, I think, for supply chains generally.
Hell, Jack, I realized a few things while watching and listening to that back. One is, I don't like listening to myself. You could tell Jack does all the editing because I don't like that at all. Two is, I look terrible with the ski tash. What's three? Three is, I really get into things. Like, you can see my face at the start. I was about to deliver such a bomb. Like, it was, I get so into things, it's ridiculous. And obviously the things I'm into is milk and like farms digitally signing about their milk. It's such a ridiculous thing to get passionate about.
I think you've introduced cows and milk into like four or five different analogies so far on the podcast, and I have to sit through them at least twice when I edit these things. But I that clip, for me, I like it because, again, you can see the enthusiasm at the start because of about what the tirade you're about to go on. But it does age like a fine wine, that clip, right? Because it starts off simple. It starts off with the basics, and then you add in IoT, and then you add in automation, and then you add in payments being triggered by devices. And I think that is, all jokes aside, that is a really nice journey that you're taking us on there, and you're seeing how these different bits of Web3 do fit together into a kind of really cohesive story. So that's why I picked that one.
I think it ages like a fine milk, not very well. I love this stuff. Like, I've always said that I'm an absolute proponent of that so much innovation now has to come from the overlap of different disciplines, and the ability to overlap IoT, which, you know, I'm passionate about, and then AI, and then also digital identity, and then finally blockchain with crypto payments. I think that stuff really excites me. And I don't really think we've seen a world yet where we have IoT devices with true agency. And I think, like, similar to the AI piece here, it's coming, and we really need it to be able to interact, transact, commit payments along these payment rails that we just couldn't do in traditional fiat systems. So yeah, it's a really funny use case, but you're right. I absolutely love that stuff. I get really passionate about it. That was the smart contracts angle as well, which I think is super exciting. The idea of 30 billion devices or whatever it's going to be, being able to just independently interact around the world and just pay for things, and the amount of improvements that's going to make to supply chain. Supply chains are so boring, but so important. And yeah, I love that stuff. So thanks for that one, Jack. Yeah.
You don't need another person in the room for a conversation about supply chains and IoT, Alec. It's obvious, but it's nice. And I like, it shows the passion you've had, you know, from the start of the podcast, even though by this episode, I think the polish is also a bit more there too. So yeah. So what have you got for me? What pain are you going to make me endure now? I'm not looking forward to this.
Yeah, so I don't like watching any of our stuff back, but it was painful me just trying to find a clip of us both. So I've taken us to, everyone knows who's been listening to Jack, he's a very calm, collected person. He loves to, he's the stability on the show. But I think this episode I'm about to show was episode 19, so still somewhat early days, and it was around the idea of decentralization. And I think I really like this episode because Jack gets very passionate about this stuff, and I think this clip shows that. So here we go.
It's really interesting that you use the word distributed there as well, because there's a very fine distinction between decentralization and distribution, or something that's decentralized versus just distributed. Because I think we tend to use the word decentralized in the context of kind of open, permissionless systems like blockchains, where you have people can come and leave, and it's an open protocol. and decentralization, because there are different flavors of decentralization actually as well, we'll come on to, but really the meaningful sense is kind of decentralization of power. So who has the power to update the blockchain, for example, who has power to change the system? And this, if something is distributed, it's more tends to mean in the flavor of it's like a distribution of resources, having backups, the local copies. And Bitcoin does a bit of this both, but you can have a distributed system that is centralized from a power perspective. You know, like if you think of something like Facebook or Twitter or Amazon, they are operating massive distributed systems because they have servers and data centers across the world, which are kind of keeping local backups and things. So you know, decentralization for me is much more apt in an open blockchain type context.
Got you. So like my understanding of the white paper, which is obviously the Bitcoin white paper, is that it actually doesn't use the term decentralization, right? But it does use the term distributed. Is that correct?
I think so, yeah. It's an interesting observation.
Don't pretend like you don't know it word for word. Like pretend you think so. It's on his wall somewhere, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to be coy about these things. But yeah, I do know it pretty well. It talks about the word honest much more than it talks about anything like decentralization. And actually, that's an interesting point, is that a lot of people, when they talk about Bitcoin and similar blockchain systems, I've often heard people say the whole point of Bitcoin is decentralization. They say it's the end, right? And this, they might sometimes just say it's the means to the end as well. But they say that's the core point of it. And I have always thought of decentralization as more of an emergent property. So Bitcoin has this design that enables, you know, peer-to-peer electronic cash, and as a result of how it's designed, it is always decentralized in the power sense. It's not like, oh, it must be decentralized and that's the end goal. No, it's the end goal is digital cash, and as a result of doing that properly, it ends up having to be decentralized.
Honestly, where do I start with that clip, Alex? So you said that's me being passionate. I'd hate to see me on a bad day if that's the case, because I was pretty monotone and dry there. But I could see what you mean after you'd said the word Bitcoin. My eyes did a little bit then, and I got into it. And yeah, this is clearly, I think this one was about 15 episodes before you told me I need to smile more. In no uncertain terms, you said you need to start smiling. Guests are getting angry that they're worried that you don't like them. So this was clearly before that. But yeah, I like the topic, so I'm glad you picked it for that reason.
I think at that same point, I was like, you need to get on the sunbeds as well, because it looks like I'm recording with Casper the Friendly Ghost over here. You can see it, Raj.
I've clearly done that.
No, but seriously, I really like this clip. I like this entire episode because we address something that it comes up all the time in this space. Again, everyone talking about decentralization, a lot of anarchists jumping onto this word and being like, get rid of all the governments, we don't need them, we don't need anything like that. And I think, you know, in the paper itself and more generally, we are coming to an understanding that that's not the case. We can't just expect to remove every intermediary in the world in this Web3 paradigm. We're always going to need some form of intermediary, some form of KYC provider or something like this. And I think really importantly, decentralization has become this nasty term that's misused. And I think more and more we need to maybe use the word distributed to describe the network rather than decentralized. But yeah, I thought you were really passionate towards the end there, Jack. This is our 52nd episode. I can tell when you're getting excited and your pitch slightly changed towards the end.
Yeah, it went from one note of monotone to a very slightly higher note of monotone, but there we go. Hopefully there'll be an even more enthused clip in a year's time. But yeah, so leaving my pasty-faced nature behind for a moment, I think to end the episode now, to end this kind of retrospective on our first year, every episode we ask two standard questions, right? We obviously ask our guests to give us their one sentence definition of what they think Web3 is, right? And often it's not one sentence, but we've actually got them picked out some of our favorites. So my favorite definition actually came from one of our earlier guests, Mona Teasler. So she's in the investment world, right? And she's also clearly very passionate about Web3. And I think this is a really nice crystallization of the core point of Web3.
Web3 to me is the new era or the future of the internet as we know it, which means you can also own your data rather than big tech giants owning your data.
That was punchy.
you can tell that Mona really understands this because she's thinking about every word. Like when I talk, I have no idea what I'm going to say. And most of the time it doesn't come out right. But Mona really gets this stuff and it's clear. That's probably one of the punchiest one-liners on how to define Web3. That's really great. So my favorite definition of Web3 comes from Gracie Chen, who is the director of BitGet. And I think maybe you remember this one. She jumps into Chinese for this. And I really loved it. I think it's so punchy and so interesting. And here's the clip.
This is actually easier to explain in Chinese, but because there's a three interesting words that distinguishes Web1, Web2, Web3. It's all called jian in Chinese, but Web1 is like han jian, meaning like I just see it. I see it, I observe it. And Web2 is jian ding, and that means I interact with it. I kind of, you know, I can send Twitter, I can share, I can social, do social media, etc. And then Web3 is called jian shu, that means building. So I'm not just observing, interacting, I'm also participating in the build of Web3. I hope this helps as a you know, elementary Chinese lesson as well, not just Web3.
Yeah, that's another really great choice, Alec. I remember this one being one where at the time I was like, wow, this is very powerful in not just the message, but also how she stated it and how she explained it. I really like that. And it gets to the heart of, we've seen, I think pretty much at the same time this episode came out, the book Read, Write, Own, right, from Chris Dixon. And that has been taken on as one of the most kind of seminal works on Web3. And I think this is exactly what Gracie was expressing here. So yeah, she was completely ahead of the curve in my view. That's a great shout. Okay. Now, Ali, I just want to give a couple of honorable mentions here, right? So we said how punchy those last two were. We have some people take punchiness to mean pure conciseness. And I think there are two really nice examples here. So first is one from David Palmer. It's just three words. So here it is.
In one sentence, what is Web3 to you?
Trust and opportunity.
Yeah, it's a really nice one. And it gives a little bit of room for interpretation, I think, as well. And then we also had one from Sam Simmons, who'd been talking to us about MintPass and how Web3 is changing travel experiences. And he just gave us a two-word explanation, which I really liked.
So in one sentence, what is Web3 to you?
Digital ownership. I'll take your sentence and I'll give you two words.
And wow, that's great. You know I love Sam. You know I love the MintPass project. I think Web3 travel is super exciting and he's really done very well there. So I wonder if anyone gets a one-word answer or a zero-word answer. Let's see.
Yeah, it's something to aim for. If you're going to be on the show in the next year, guys, then make sure you aim for a one-worder. But yeah, so that kind of brings us to the end, I think. This is definitely fun for me, Alec. I don't know about you, but yeah, I've really enjoyed looking back at our various forms of our past selves, looking at the terrible recording setups. At least we've both got mics to our mouths these days, which is definitely an improvement.
Yeah, man. 100 more years, baby. 100 more years.
Oh, geez, Rick. Oh, man. We're so dirty. So, yeah, before we lose any more subscribers now, Alec, I think that's a great place to sign off. And yeah, at home, thank you for listening, wherever you may be. Join us next time to untangle a little more Web3.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3, produced by Emma Camilleri.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.